Welcome to the podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. Our podcast weaves together the message and a taste of the music that we experience each Sunday morning as we root our lives in grace through worship here at The Table. More and more people are finding their way to The Table through this podcast, so if you are one of the many, many folks who tune in each week from other parts of California, other parts of our country, or even from other places in the world, we would invite you to take a next step in growing in faith here at The Table. You can do that online at our website, thetableumc.org. There you'll find links to social media and also a way to make a deep commitment to our community to express how you hope to root your life in grace, to grow in faith, to reach in love, and to give generously. If you're one of the many people listening to this but haven't quite walked through the door of the sanctuary yet on a Sunday morning, we would love to welcome you into the beauty of this sanctuary. We gather each Sunday for worship at 9:30 and at 11. Our address is 5265 H Street in East Sacramento.
I want to have eyes of love. Precious as my own, offer my back for my neighbor's load. I want to have eyes of love. I want to have eyes of love.
This is the piece of music that we opened worship with. I want to have eyes of love, count the beggar's life precious as my own, offer my back for my neighbor's load. I want to have eyes of love. As much as I want to watch over others with eyes of love, I stumble. It seems that I have this basic need for self-protection, for self-preservation that kicks in over and over and over, no matter how much I want to have eyes of love. Sometimes I think that it's fear, sometimes resentment, arrogance, insecurity. I want to have eyes of love, yet more often than not, I find it easier to hurt others than to fully love others. And this desire for self-preservation, at least in me, it runs really deep. It starts as a young child, and then it is shaped in who I am and how I move. And so over these next 3 weeks, we as a community of faith are going to reflect together on what does it mean for church to really be a school for teaching us how to love one another. That this is the central purpose that Jesus set for his people, to go and to love each other. And yet so often we, as folks who long to follow, who want to follow in the ways of Jesus, struggle to do so. We're going to use the writings of a person who teaches at Duke University. His name is Norman Wurzba. And we've used the book Way of Love to shape our worship series. And we hope his writing is going to help give structure to how we move together over these 3 weeks to reflect on church as a school for teaching us how to love. And Wurzba writes this: if Christianity is not fundamentally about enabling people to love, it should cease to exist. His aim is not simply to suggest that Christianity has interesting things to say about love. It's actually to show that love is the essential movement. It's the core and the climax of life and faith. Christianity teaches in 1 John 4:8 that God is love. And that means that authentic faith is realized as people witness to and learn to participate in the love that is God's own life. And so we often think about God as an object or as a subject out there. But if Christianity teaches that God is love, then it might help us more to think about God as a verb, as love as a verb. And that to get caught up in love is to get caught up in God. And that's our way of life. Not so much a set of beliefs or things that we hold, but a whole way of structuring our life together. The psalmist prays about it and sings about it this way: "Teach me your way, O Lord, that I may walk in your truth." Just that subtle phrase, that I may walk in your truth. It's not that I may sit here and remember your truth, that I may sit here and remind myself of all the decrees that you have given. It's an active way of being that the psalmist longs for. I long to walk in your ways, God. And the truth is that most of us don't have any problem with saying that love should be central to Christianity. That gets said over and over and over again in all kinds of different ways. But making it actually happen, or allowing God's love to work on us enough to open ourselves up for it to happen, that's a whole nother thing. That's a whole nother challenge. Anybody that's experienced intimate relationships knows just how difficult love can be. It is not easy, and it is not without its own messiness. See, we can be mistaken about what love is and what it entails, which is why I believe that we need one another to be on this journey together. It's so easy to be misguided by our own sense of love, and we need an ongoing education in love if we're to follow these ways. Wordsworth writes that Christianity is a training ground for precisely this sort of education. If love is the heart of Christianity, then training in love must be at the center of what Christian faith is about. That's my hope for what the table is about training all of us in loving one another. And like intimate relationships, that's neither easy nor without its own challenges and messiness. And over these 3 weeks, we're going to try to live and reflect on some of those. Richard Rohr, who is himself a priest, writes this: "Most of us were taught that God would love us if and when we change." I experience this over and over as I encounter people here at the table. Most of us are taught that God would love us if and when we change. In fact, God loves you so that you can change. What empowers change, what makes you desirous of change, is the experience of love. It's the inherent experience of love that becomes the engine of change. And so I want to share a little bit about a community that is in Algeria that I believe expresses and embodies church as a way of love and allows themselves to be seen with God's eyes of love so that they can be changed and transformed. This is a community, they're called Trappist monks. They take their origin around 1664 when the abbot of a Trappist, or of a monastic community there called La Trappe Abbey. I know most of you know La Trappe because they also make really good beer. So we'll get that out of the way. They do that really well, and they teach people how to love really well also. There's a lot of things that they're very good at. This community started, it was originally called the Order of Cistercians of the Strict Observance. It's a Roman Catholic religious order, and what happened in 1664 is that the abbot looked on at how all the monks were practicing their faith and decided they are not strict enough. This is way too lax. People are not really deep in their faith. We have people come to us a lot about after they've been in a kitchen table for a while and they struggle with, I want to go deeper. And usually when we want to go deeper, we usually think somebody else needs to do that for me. Somebody else needs to make that happen. And so these monks looked on, and instead of saying like, the rest of these people have no idea what's going on, they said, you know what, we're going to find our own way. And we're going to call it the Order of Cistercians of the Strict Observance. Like in the name itself tells you how strict these folks are. So Trappist is the way we talk about it. And there are male Trappist monk communities. And then there are also nuns. Trappistines is what they call themselves. They follow the rule of Benedict. Benedict lived around the 6th century. And what he wanted was people to devote their lives to following God by intentional and attention to details of everyday life. So they lived very simple lives. They prayed together. They sang. They broke bread. They found ways to love each other. And they saw that in loving each other, they would love God. And everything else was just a distraction. So they take a vow. They take a vow, 3 different vows, actually. One is to stability. One is to fidelity to monastic life. And one's to obedience. They are strict. They gather around vegetarian meals and they sit in silence. They don't take a vow of silence, but they believe that words most often just detract us from God. So we would be better off holding the depth of silence as a way to experience God than by allowing our words to get in the way. So when you enter a community, a Trappist community, the silence is deafening. And for people that move in the world like me, addicted to my phone and moving around all the time, it's the anxiety level goes way up. And then you witness in their lives just a profound expression of slowing down into the rhythms of God's grace and love. And so these monks follow in this way. They live together in poverty, and their whole life is about how do we live in sustainable ways and serve the neighbors around us. This is the abbey there in France. They live a life of poverty, but they also have a lot of structures that are in place. Like, that is a beautiful monastic community to live in. So there is also, there are structures around them that support them in this way. This next image is Brother Luke at the top. Brother Luke became a Trappist monk in 1941. He was trained as a physician, and he served in the French military. He left all of that and gave his life over to God and to this way of life of being a monk. Many of us might be aware of his story. In 2011, there was a film that won the best foreign film at Cannes. It's called Of Gods and Men. And so I want to just, first service, no one had seen Of Gods and Men. Has anyone seen Of Gods and Men? One of us. Okay, I can pretty much say anything about Of Gods and Men, and we're not going to be worried because you don't know. But I'm going to do my best, and I actually think this might be a powerful way if you are looking for how to mark September 11th. This movie I've watched earlier this week, and it just stays with me over and over, over and over and over again. It's coming up. This movie tells the story of the seven monks that we just saw, Brother Luke being one of them. And their whole life is lived together in a monastic community area. They live outside of a Muslim community. And their whole life is spent trying to watch over with eyes of love the Muslim sisters and brothers who live around them. That's what they dedicate everything to. They gather and they pray and they sing together for about 4 hours every day. They eat together in silence at meals, and then one brother will stand up and read from the gospel and from theologians about how God loves them, and then God's love for them needs for them to be changed and transformed, that they could be an expression of that. Brother Luke has one assistant. His name is Brother Amadi. He's in his late 80s. And these two old men go out, Brother Luke as a doctor, and they were serving over 150 patients, Muslim patients, in the little clinic that they had set up every day. I know some of the doctors around us, like 100, just do the math on how many people you're seeing. 150 patients a day these men were seeing. They sold honey at the market. They held deep silence together. They gave their lives, literally, their lives were taken as they watched over with eyes of love their neighbors. The film is a powerful meditation on the depths of Christianity as a school for love. You see, as the film opens, you see Brother Christian, that's him in there in the middle. You see him at his desk, and on one side is the Rule of Benedict, which shapes his life, and then on the other side is the Quran. And then you see them out praying with their Muslim sisters and brothers. You see them gathering together to hold on to one another and to farm and to listen for how God is calling them in their lives. The monastery is a school for love, and then the story of these men became a school of love for the actors that played them. One of the actors, his name is Lambert Wilson, and he plays the leader, Brother Christian, there in the middle. He says this, that through learning to chant psalms, we became brothers. So you know that I don't play a doctor, or I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV. Like, through playing this, they actually touched the heart of Christianity. Another of the actors says, to chant psalms is to breathe together, to share the breath of life. And the life is a beautifully simple one. And it's like they have seven Omaris singing together. So you kind of get a sense that these seven men are also the most beautiful musicians that you'll ever hear in your life. It wasn't like me and Lunar going back and forth trying to harmonize. That was not it. But the truth is, I think, I have no idea what they sounded like, but their life was music. Their life was an expression of deep and beautiful music. And that depth never takes us away from the troubles of the world. Love never allows that to happen. Love calls us deep into the most profound troubles of every age. And this was the case for these Trappist monks who lived on the edge of a Muslim community in Algeria when a small sect of radicalized Islamist folks called the Armed Islamic Group started to rise and to create terror in the community there. The Algerian government started to just crumble around them. And life, as they had known it, in this beautiful little idyllic space, started to collapse. And as that happened, the monks were struggling in ways that they, I don't think, ever really imagined with what it meant to love their neighbors. See, these were monks who had come from France to live there in Algeria and had done so for years, but then their lives were being threatened. On Christmas Eve, at least as the movie depicts it, on Christmas Eve, the armed uprising came into their monastery, and they demanded that they take all of the medicines that were meant for the neighborhood, for the community of people that they were watching over in love, and they wanted Brother Luke to come with them as well to care for their own fighters. And so these monks were forced to face right in front of them a real enemy. And what does it mean to love enemy and to also love the neighbors around? And they struggled with it. At that moment, Brother Christian quotes in the Quran back to this militant leader as he invites him to see his own Islamic faith as a way of love, and then says that today is like no other day. We as Christians gather together to worship the Prince of Peace who was born helpless to a woman out in the middle of nowhere. And they just stand there in this uncomfortable silence. So what are you going to do? Are the medicines going to stay here for the people in the neighborhood, or are you going to hand them over to your enemy? Who is your enemy and who is your neighbor? They struggle with these questions in ways that most of us can't fathom. And they're human. They're human. These monks are human beings who fear and agonize over what they should do. Like, should we allow the military to come in and to protect us? Should we just let go of all the medicine and head back to France? What does it mean to love our neighbors in this very moment? Brother Christian refuses to bow to pragmatism, and he conforms instead to a higher logic of love. He says, "We are martyrs out of love, out of fidelity. Love endures everything." He embraces a younger monk, one who feels like they should leave. They should leave the monastery and go to France where their lives won't be in danger. He holds him and says that it's through poverty and death that we advance toward God. I want to be clear that they don't seek death. It's not what they're doing, but they're not fearing it either. They practice a way of life that reminds them in all that they are and all that they do, that God sees them with eyes of love and wants them to be changed, to be transformed, to express love in all that they are to their neighbors. And the movie depicts a Last Supper scene for them. And kind of like I imagine Jesus' Last Supper, I don't think these monks had any idea that this was their last meal. I don't think Jesus had any sense that this was it. I don't think that Dr. King imagined that this is the last one. And at the same moment, they deeply recognized that any meal could be their last one. And it was out of that reverence and sacredness that they were able to see every meal as sacred. And so I want to show you just a two-minute clip from Of Gods and Men. I want to invite you to look at the eyes of these men who really want to have eyes of love. You'll see, or I see, as they share this last meal, both hope and fear and joy. Let's watch. Brother Amadi, who wants to have eyes of love, and what that looks like for him is every day as a man well into his 80s, picking up some medicine and going with Dr. Luke and trying to reach in love to neighbors around him. For those with eyes to see, Of Gods and Men is a quiet and profound and troubling meditation on what Christianity looks like when it is a school for love. Those eyes of love have had a lot to teach me this week. Norman Wirzba challenges us that the love of God presents each person with a paradox. Abundance of life requires that people learn to give themselves away in service to others. I think this is a profoundly challenging and hard thing to hold. I want to say it again. Abundance of life requires that people learn to give themselves away in service to others. For it is in this self-offering movement that life is fully affirmed, nurtured, and celebrated. Most often, most of us don't have eyes to see that. And I think it's why we need to keep coming back to community to root our lives in grace. See, the witness of these monks depended on a community of instruction and support. They couldn't do it on their own. They relied on liturgical rhythms, on disciplines of daily prayer, on breaking bread together, on allowing their lives to be broken open and shaped by a God whose way is love. And so as this civil war erupted in Algeria, closer at home to the monastery, the monks faced a deep temptation to turn and to flee, to place their hope either in a military or in security that they might find by simply letting go of the troubles that were their lives. And in the course of their deliberation, Brother Christian read for them this passage from another monk who died 2 years earlier in Algeria. He writes this: "To accept our lack of power and our poverty is an invitation and an urgent call to create with others relationships that are not based on power. When I recognize my weakness, I can accept that of others and see a way for me to imitate Christ. This attitude transforms our mission. It invites us to renounce all pretension of superiority in our encounters with others, however weak they might be. This attitude of weakness can be misunderstood. Weakness in itself is not a virtue, but rather an expression of the essence of our nature, one which must be molded and shaped by faith, hope, and love. To be weak is to be neither passive nor resigned. Rather, it supposes courage and pushes us to struggle for justice and truth while resisting the elusive seduction of force and power. Brother Luke and his fellow monks found their entire lives broken open by the land and the people in Algeria. Their hearts were opened up, and they were inspired by both the pain and the joy of life together with their neighbors around them. They were held by the memory and the witness of Jesus Christ as they faced what would become their own death. By being together, they learned that it takes mutual nurture to give up our own presumed powers so that we can become a loving community that has rooted itself in weakness. And I don't know about you, but it's tempting for me when I look on at a story like this to think these are people whose love is just so profound that God can't possibly need me to do anything like that. These are just extraordinary people who did something that you make movies about, and then Cannes gets awards for them. So let's go on to brunch, people. Like, that's a part of me. I want to acknowledge that part of me. And here's the extraordinary stuff they did. They saw their neighbors, and they did their best to love them. They saw folks that were around them that were sick, and they said, I want to help heal people. They broke bread together at a table, and they prayed. Extraordinary things like singing together and saying that I want to carry my brother's load on my back. It's extraordinary. Or maybe Brother Luke is as ordinary as you can possibly imagine. And what's extraordinary is that the circumstances that he found himself in, he was able to keep that course. And I don't know if I would or could, but I know that I'm called to the same kind of ordinary loving that he was, that you are, that we all are, that God longs for us to find. These men embodied it. We find over and over in our community of faith folks that are feeling called to some form of ministry. And so they're coming to Linda or myself asking questions about this. In the last couple months, we sent Christina to be a pastor in North Carolina and Lori to be a pastor over in the Bay Area. We sent two people to seminary. And then last Sunday, we had a conversation with one and we're getting ready to have another. Like, so many people around here are feeling that God is calling them to something deep. But I have yet to have somebody come to me and say, I am feeling that God is calling me to be a monk in a community and to have this strict observance, to give up everything that I have, and to pray for 4 hours a day with people around me, to break bread and to not talk very much. No one has come to me yet and said, that's where God is calling me. But folks, I want to be honest. When I look on at their lives, I feel deeply challenged and wonder, what am I really doing? What am I really doing? See, there are folks you can learn. Brendan tried to teach me, and even I could learn to play a few notes on the piano. And you can play notes without playing music. And friends, these folks play music with their faith. They don't just say, I want to have eyes of love, count the beggar's life precious as my own, offer my back for my neighbor's load. That becomes their way of life. Jesus says, I'm the way and the life and the truth. That's the way that they take on. We have wanted nothing more than the table to be that kind of a school. When we were here sitting on this floor back before we had this fancy concrete and this nice carpet, it was ragtag and there was seams coming up everywhere and this was like pink and those were purple and it was just a mess of chaos of colors. And we sat here in this space and we said, how is it with your soul? And we wondered about what to do next. And we held on to each other, hoping that this place, by rooting our lives in grace and then gathering in kitchen tables to watch over each other in love and then finding ways to reach in love, that we could become a school for teaching each other how to love. We thought that's what we were doing earlier in the summer. Every week, Pastor Linda and I send out questions to our kitchen table leaders. And we spend time prayerfully reflecting on these. And earlier in the summer, we sent out questions that caused a slight uproar among folks. We did it because we wanted to teach each other how to love, and we wanted to live into that together. And the questions invited us to think together, to work together, on how might we actively resist forms of institutionalized racism. The truth that my life as a white person is valued differently than a black person's life in this very same space. Like, how do we address this? This is huge. How do we work on this? How do we acknowledge, first of all, that racism is real? And what do we do about it once we acknowledge it? And we sent these questions out, and I think we sent them out because we wanted to have eyes of love. We wanted to be in that together with you all. I wanted my life to count the same, not more than the life of a black person. And a few folks were upset by our questions, by our approach. Some folks were concerned that if we talk about race, we're going to be racist. That talking about race equals that. Some were concerned, and they expressed this, that we were straying from the way of love. And on some level, I fear that we did. Not for the reasons that people were always naming. But the truth is that our kitchen table leaders didn't feel equipped to talk about race and inclusion and diversity. And we hadn't done all that we could to help that. And then, in particular kitchen tables, there was one person of color who was left to talk about race and racism in an all-white group besides them. And that was our mistake. We really screwed up. And we held that, and we regret it. We wish we'd done better, and we want to keep at it. We know that for church to be a school of love, we're going to need to take risks and struggle and stumble. And we know that love isn't easy. We know that it's messy. You saw it in the lives of these Algerian monks. These were folks who were the grandsons of colonizers in Algeria. They were French, and they could leave at any given moment because the church had all the power it needed to take them safely back home, where they did not have to struggle or worry about what it meant to love their neighbors right there in Algeria. And they struggled with this. They agonized. Some were ready to take off. And they decided together that they were going to stay. They were going to stand side by side with their neighbors whose lives were not being cared for and loved in the way that they were. And they did just that. And almost all of them did lose their lives. We decided last Sunday, we had a powerful worship right here in this space. I feel like we almost always have a powerful worship. Sometimes we get out of the way and God's power just moves in this space, and that happened last Sunday. And then we placed right outside a sign, a flag that says Black Lives Matter in the front lawn in East Sacramento. And you don't see those very often in East Sacramento. We did it because we believe that God's eyes see and love each and every person in this world, and that we as a people are failing over and over to see the same. And so we want to stand with where we believe God is standing, and to name that and to claim that. We know that we as a church, I know that I as a person have a great deal to struggle with around issues of race and inclusion and diversity. And that God's not going to let me go while we do that. God didn't let those monks go in Algeria as they decided to stay put and to stand in solidarity with their neighbors. And God won't let any of us go either. And the truth is that some people will see the sign and they're going to add a word in. And to them, all they're going to see is only Black Lives Matter. That'll happen. Some folks will see it and feel that this is shaming or blaming. Some are going to be concerned, like, so do white lives matter? And I don't want to try to take those questions away or resolve them easily for you. But I do know this, that when Jesus was invited to share a word for the very first time in the Gospel of Luke, he pulls out the scroll in Isaiah, and he stands on the tradition that has gone before him. And he says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because the Lord has anointed me, sent me to preach good news to the poor, proclaim release to the prisoners and recovery of sight to the blind, to liberate the oppressed and proclaim the year of God's favor." Jesus said that in the synagogue of his hometown. That's his way of planting a flag that says, poor lives matter. Prisoners' lives matter. The lives of blind people matter. He could have been bland and just says, everybody counts. He chose to be specific because Jesus was in relationship with people who the powers that be did not recognize their lives as sacred. And Jesus says, this is not okay. And so sometimes love is messy and challenging. The monks, I said, they were not all on the same page. It wasn't like the people came, the folks came with their weapons. The monks were like, well, we're all going to do this. We're all on the same page. Brother Christian was out there by himself, and the others were like, let's let him in. The other people, some folks were like, let's have the military come in. They were not all together on this, but they stayed in it, and they said, I want to listen to your story, and I want to tell my story. What they kept coming back to is, why did I choose to go all in with God? Why did I even become a monk in the first place? And my hope is that we'll work on that question together. Like, what led you to this very space? Over and over, what I experience is that people long to be part of a community that says God's unconditional love matters, and we want to allow that love to change us. And the trouble with that is, changing us is hard. It's really, really hard. And so some of the ways that we want to be changed, just a few weeks ago, Linda and myself and the folks that lead all of our kitchen tables met with two people from our community whose whole life is spent trying to help people work on issues of inclusivity and diversity and race. And we've come up with some ways that we want to work on this as a community. So in October, we're going to bring together folks that will be in leadership in 2017 and have conversations around this. And then in January, we're going to take that next layer out so that all of our kitchen table leaders and folks that are on hospitality and folks that are working in our children's ministry, we're all going to have these conversations. And then we're going to continue to. And I don't think it's going to be simple. I don't think there's an easy answer to this. But you saw it on those eyes that wanted to love. They longed to figure out what that actually meant in their lives. And I believe that God needs us to do the very same thing right here in this space. See, the truth is that I've spent countless hours here on this campus in the last 6 years. I have never one time, not once that I'm aware of, had my own physical presence frighten another person, bring up fear for them, not once. When we were starting the table, 6 years ago, Anthony Coleman became our first music director. Where's Megan Kilpatrick? Megan was here for a couple weeks, and then she moved to a farm to work with children. So Megan was with us a couple weeks, and then Anthony came on. We were going to meet in this space to plan for worship. And as we did, I had a staff person from the nursery that used to be here. It's closed. But this person came to me, and she wanted me to know that we needed to call the police, because there is a black man who is here on campus, and there's children that are here. I have never in 6 years here had any worry about anything. That's a privilege that I just go through life with. And his first moment of coming to this campus, that's what happened. And we can often see racism outside of us and be like, I would never do that. I'm not racist. So here's the backstory of that. When we learned that Megan was going to leave, we interviewed two people. Anthony was one. Anthony is now moved down to New Orleans. Anthony is African-American young man who plays the trumpet. He has a master's that he's going to work on right now. And we interviewed a young woman who was white, and she worked in a mainline church. And she played classical music, not jazz. And so I had all kinds of ways that I was like, we're going to hire the white woman, that I was not conscious of. The primary one was, what kind of church would have its first music director be a trumpet player? That is not a good idea. And The truth is that there was a lot going on inside of me and inside of us as we were making those decisions. And so racism isn't just something that is out there. It's something that is inside of us that God needs for us to see, that God's eyes of love see us, and that God longs for us to change. God's love is that engine. As Jesus says, I'm the way and the truth and the life. It's not about saying that we need to believe this set of doctrines or that Jesus is showing us like a few tricks to love each other. Jesus is literally saying to the people that follow him, I am the way and the truth and the life. And that is our invitation as a church, is to say yes back to that. It's not a few teachings or techniques. It's to offer ourselves in sacrifice. It's not a strategic thing to do. The world doesn't often say yes back to that. But the truth is that when we want to have eyes of love, when we want to count the beggar's life precious as our own, when we want to offer our neighbor our back for our neighbor's load, when we want to have eyes of love, God shows us that way. The love of Jesus is that way. So may that way be our way in this moment and in all of our lives. Amen.
In times like these, we need to be strong. We need to carry on. We need to get along, hold on, and right what's wrong.
In times like these, we need to find a way to make a better day. Keep our feet on the ground, turn around, come what may. Everybody needs someone they can lean on. Everybody needs to lean on someone. Everybody needs someone they can lean on. Everybody needs to lean on someone now.